Coming up on this episode of Inside Pop,
we are talking with cinematographer Graham Willoughby about the process of crafting beautiful imagery for award-winning documentary films and series.
Plus, it's the podcast that's shining a light on the music of Frank Ocean. It's all happening right now on Inside Pop. Hey everyone, I'm Sean David Johnson.
And I'm Amita Patel, and this is Inside Pop, your deep dive inside the world of pop culture.
Now, we just want to take a moment to let you know that if you are listening to us on Apple Podcasts, head on over to the iTunes app, give us a quick rating and review, and let everyone know how much you enjoy the podcast.
Huge thanks in advance for doing all of that lovely work just for us. Now, we are extremely happy to welcome our guest, Graham Willoughby.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Graham is a master cinematographer who has worked on numerous TV and film documentaries, including the 2014 Academy Award-winning documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom. Graham has also worked on acclaimed series, Abstract and Ugly Delicious on Netflix, and most recently, the Mr. Rogers documentary that is giving everyone the feels, Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Graham, we are so excited to have you here. And I want to start with what is going to sound like a very basic question, but I think it's something that stumps even people who work in TV and film. Can you let the listeners know the difference between, or if there is a difference between, a director of photography and a cinematographer?
You know, somebody else asked me that question, and I feel like it's a RC Cola, Coca-Cola, Pepsi question. I don't really know the subtle variations of that recipe. I'm sure there's some person who is mad right now that I can't distinguish between a cinematographer, a DOP, a DP, and somebody who's lensing. So I think probably just depends on if you have a a beret or a scarf or a pipe, and maybe you choose the right moniker for that.
So which one are you, the pipe?
I would love to do a pipe, but Wally Pfister beat me to it. I think that would be such an amazing thing. Instead of having the big head, geared head with big camera there, I'd love to have just a picture of me with a pipe just pointing off into the distance. But like I said, it's already been done more classically by the master, so I can't second string that.
Of course. And so now we've broken that myth there, that they are eventually basically the same. So can you define what a DP does?
Well, I think a DP does different things for different people. I think the director will lean into a DP for doing different strokes for different folks. Like one director might want a DP to craft the image, you know, kind of a Roger Deakins, you know, I'm leaning into you to help kind of build a world here that I can vibe with. And some other people might, on the other extreme, be looking for somebody to just kind of go along and subscribe to the vision that the director has and just kind of make it happen. So I think ultimately what has the DP's job is to the best of their ability, serve the visual requirements of the capture. And you work with different directors, and some of them have a better landscape in their head, and you just have to help them find that. And other directors lean into you for making something out of nothing. And you know, I think it's pretty exciting to be able to collaborate on something and make it, whether it's holding them by the hand, or you're actually kind of steaming that ship yourself.
And I think it's so cool because I think being a cinematographer is one of those things where to me it seems you're 50% left brain and 50% right brain, right? There's like a huge amount of creativity that's needed, but you also need to know your technical stuff, your lighting, your cameras, your lenses. And it really does require both sides of your brain to be firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, there is that. There's the craft of it. And then there's the sort of creativity, sort of openness of it all. And then there's also the sort of the camaraderie of it. I mean, I think one of the things that I love so much about this job is that there is this community that you can't do it on your own. You can't just go out there and make it happen. You have to lean into the support of everybody around you, and you're as good as the team that you can build and can work with around you. And that's something that maybe doesn't get talked about as much, but it's one of the things that I love the most, is just being able to kind of be around a bunch of other people and You know, it's in a way, it's a little bit like emergency management from the outside. I've never really done emergency management, but you're just sort of plopped into a situation. You don't really know any of the people around you. You just got to get from A to Z, and you got to figure out the most efficient way to make it happen. And that's kind of the cool thing about being on a film set, is you just got to find a way. You don't necessarily have everything you want or everything you need, but you just lean into each other, and the village makes it happen. It's a really cool career.
Definitely. It always takes a village, right?
Yeah. Well, not always. Sometimes there's those people that just, you know, by the force of their own will steer that ship, you know, into the waves. And that's a pretty amazing skill, but it's a different thing from the way I like to work.
Yeah. So how did you get your start?
I sort of fell into the puddle, and then the puddle became a pond, and then the pond became a lake, and then the lake kind of fed into the ocean, and that's how I did it. You know, I just was looking the other way, and there I was, all wet. I was going to be a math teacher.
Love that.
And then I didn't want to be a math teacher, and so I found anything other than that. So I was magnetically, you know, moving in opposition to that, and I hit waiting tables, and I hit, you know, some comedy stuff, and I hit electric work in the film business, and that just kind of fed into lighting, and it fed into camera work, and there I was all of a sudden, 15 years later, behind the you know, the eyepiece of a camera. And it just felt right. That just sounds like a weird thing. It felt right, like some kind of a bad.
Wow.
I was in love.
Love at first sight.
That's amazing, though. Yeah, what mm-hmm. a journey.
Well, kind of love at, you know, 199th sight.
Right.
We'd been in the same dance hall for a long time. And then eventually.
Either you or cinematography was playing hard to get, right?
Yeah. A little coquettish. But it's cool. I mean, it's cool. It was cool for me to sort of, I mean, the one thing that I feel like that's wild about it is that what was a sort of a great handicap for me was that, you know, I always had several burners on the stove, and I was always super jealous of people that had the sort of monochromatic or the sort of like the myopic focus. And I felt like that's the only way to kind of get from A to Z. But it's cool to realize that there's other ways you can get there.
If you guys don't want to teach math.
Exactly. That's just one thing I want to say. All the failed math teachers out there, there's hope.
So you have a it seems like you have a very nice, productive, successful relationship with the director Morgan Neville, who directed 20 Feet from Stardom and Won't You Be My Neighbor, the new documentary about Fred Rogers. Can you talk about that collaboration? How did you two meet?
We actually met through a friend of a friend. You know, the woman that I eventually married was a friend of his. So they kind of, they had a relationship, and he was in need of somebody, and I was somebody who provided answers to those needs. And we met and it worked out, and it was just great to work with him. And he just always, you know, his jobs are always interesting, and his jobs, one job led to the next, to the next, to the next. It's, you know, he's just been a pleasure to work with him. He just really knows what he wants, and he's just really smart and really good in the edit. And, you know, you just count it a blessing if you run across one of those people. And Morgan is definitely one. He's an amazing guy.
Oh, that's amazing to hear. Lovely. I mean, how much do you thank your wife for introducing him to you?
Yeah, she's definitely got some. She's good for a lot of things. And that introduction is also pretty good.
So what's your working relationship like? You know, do you, like you said, you know, you like to collaborate more. So how does that work when he approaches you for a particular project?
When Morgan approaches me for a project, he's pretty much got it in his head. You know, he knows what he wants, and it's my job to just sort of answer those needs. And it's cool because there's some back and forth on it as to how that can be solved. But it's always something that he's sat with for a while, and so just getting that sort of translation out is something that's actually really easy. He's already sort of figured out which direction he wants to go, and we can kind of just you know, pull it out together, and it just kind of lands rather obviously right there on the table before us. It's just fantastic.
I mean, one thing that's interesting to me when I work with DPs is, like, I feel like there are two extremes, right? Like, there's the challenge a DP has of, you know, please give us some lighting and a look that just looks natural and the viewer's not even going to think about it. You know, the other side is, you know, please make this look like a scene from a Wong Kar-wai movie and like super moody, and like all you can think about is how visually cool it looks. And it's always interesting to me when I work with a DP and they get just as excited about just creating that natural look and that natural light. And I think like it basically maybe like there's a time to be showy and to draw your eye to the visuals, and there's a time to let the viewer focus on other things, but that seems like that's just as much work. Is there one extreme that you enjoy doing more than the other?
Well, I think, you know, if you're when in Rome, right? Where I think if you're doing documentaries, it feels just vile. I mean, to me personally, it feels disgusting to have like a strong edge on somebody that's unmotivated, or to have like a blue light, to have all this stuff that really draws your attention to the camera and to the scene. And I think that if you can just have this thing be where the person just instantly believes that they're actually there, that's 110% of glory. You know, that's just amazing. You know, if you're in a situation where it's candy colored and it wants to have a certain pizzazz to it, and you make it look natural, that also feels dirty. You know, if you're doing something that has to have some pizzazz, and you're just, you know, you have the natural daylight coming from the fake window, and then you have the natural fill and a little bit of shadow, and, you know, then it just feels gross because you're not serving the actual story of the scene. Whereas if you just stay true to what's supposed to be happening in front of you, it just feels right because you're doing it. Now, I've done a bunch of stuff lately where we're in the field and it's, you know, we did a bunch of testing with the Alexa Mini and all these other cameras. And one of the glorious things about that we found, everybody loves the Mini. It's cliche to love the Mini, but it's, you know, the Alexa is just such a great camera because it's so forgiving. It's like the Mother Teresa of cameras, where it just, it takes all of the sort of like normal, discomforting, not even sins, but like discomforting moods of the world, and it just fits them all into one box. It's just like, it's like the melting pot. And like you have a green fluorescent light, you have a daylight, you have a tungsten light, you have all these lights that on a two-dimensional camera plane with a sensor make sense in their own worlds. But then when you merge them all together, they can be kind of shocking unless you have something like the Alexa sensor that forgives them all and brings them together in this nice little way. And so we've been doing all this stuff where we go do documentary stuff and Verite and it's 9 times out of 10, when you bring out a light, you just make it worse. Mm. Like the environment that it's in is just so absurd, you couldn't make it look like that. You know, if you had hours, sure, you could do it and you had a picture you wanted to match it. But there's something so glorious about just going into a room and all the crazy bouncing that's going on in the room and all the crazy light that's happening in that room. It's just a thrill to just turn the camera on and point it at something and see what's happening and then kind of augment it wherever you need to augment it for the scene to make sense. But again, it's long-winded answer of just this idea of just finding what's natural in the scene and embracing it and just finding the thrill of that. It's like, you know those guys on the beach with the, and gals, with the little disc thing that they wave back and forth to try and find mm-hmm. the metal, and then they find some metal? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like that, but it's not, because it's like every time you hear something, when you try to do this available light thing, 9 times out of 10, you get this amazing Rolex watch that still works. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not like you're getting some dumb safety pin that's rotten and rusted. You get this really cool thing. I don't know. I get really excited about it. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, you no, left great. Being a math teacher, but now, like, everybody listening, you're getting a master class on being a cinematographer right now. you're really explaining and have such an eloquent way with explaining your work.
On the other extreme, though, it's like I just did this other show where we did have the ability to kind of make things a little bit more theatrical, and that was super cool, too. You know, you just, I don't know, just make it green, make it purple. Okay, good, let's shoot. And, you know, just it's thrilling, too, to just, that's kind of like the, I can't do it, but some people can just walk into a kitchen and be like, what do you have in your fridge? You know, butter, olives, and, you know, ice cream? All right, let's make a dish. And it's sort right. of fun to be able to do that with lights for me. But I can't do it with food.
So you're a chef with lights.
A visual chef. I like it.
Please don't say that.
Well, I also have to just mention how much I enjoyed the Mr. Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor. It made me cry so much. And but in a great way. It's such a beautiful documentary dedicated to an extremely kind and generous man. And I know you've probably feeling a lot of the love that this documentary has been getting over the last few months. How was approaching those scenes versus approaching a scenes about, you know, 20 Feet from Stardom, which is essentially about the backup singers to some major artists? This is about the people that were working with Mr. Rogers on this wonderful show. You know, how did you approach that with how did Morgan approach it, and how did you guys kind of decide the look for those interviews and whatever extra footage you were shooting for that documentary? Because a lot of it was archival.
Yeah, a lot of it was archival. Yeah. And, you know, that's it's such a great tool for something like mm-hmm. that. For that show just had thousands of hours of the archive.
I know.
It's just so much stuff that you could pull from. And, you know, it's just a glorious candy store for somebody who has the ability to dive deep into that. The approach, you know, Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, was somebody who was a real innovator at the time. And Morgan, and because of the way that he approached the viewer was on equal footing, and the viewer was in a shared space with him. And there was really no edifice of a camera. There was really no edifice of a studio. It was as if he was in your living room talking to you. And so that direct-to-camera engagement was something that Morgan really wanted to do, where he just felt like the people have to be able to address straight to camera. So we had that, and that's a really, that's magnetic in and of its own. And then sort of a wider and closer presence also it provides that sort of sense of exaggerated presence, and between those two things, and just a sort of sensitivity to, you know, the emotional landscape of the interview, Morgan is able to have eye to eye contact with them. They're able to have eye to eye contact with the lens, and you to have this intense relationship between the director and the talent or the interviewee. One of the sort of thrilling roles that you get to do as a DP is you get to be a matchmaker. You know, you get to sort of set these people up to have the best date possible and then try and pull yourself out of that scenario and just let it go. And so for me, it was always trying to hide myself and hide my presence and hide what we were doing. Of course we were lighting it, and of course we had light stands, and of course we had crew and a sound guy and a boom, and we had all that crap in there. But it's miraculous how much that can kind of go away once you start the interview and you can just let these two people have a conversation. And yeah, it was really amazing to sort of be able to create that sort of combined space that they could share and then just back off and stop to exist.
Yeah, and it comes through so much in that documentary. You really feel like you're getting an intimate conversation and revelations from all the people who were surrounded him, and it just the strength of those conversations obviously told his story in such a way that I think everybody was crying in that theater, and is why I think this film is getting so much love right now.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's just the beauty of the story. It's if you can be there to capture the right story, and then have the presence of mind to find the things that matter and then get rid of everything else. It's just that's the real craft of it. And I think Morgan is just really exceptional at that, just finding what's important and having the ability to get rid of whatever's less important.
Yeah.
So Graham, perusing your resume, we see a lot of music-related content, a lot of music documentaries. Is that a subject you're drawn to? It seems that you are. What is it about music, kind of capturing visuals of music, that interests you?
You know, it's funny. The music is one of my favorite things to capture, what's amazing about capturing music is that with musicians, there is a language that gets communicated that isn't clear to anyone else who's not playing it. But what is clear is how they're talking isn't necessarily clear, but that they're talking is clear. That you're in this room and somebody's playing something and they're looking over at the bass player. The bass player is looking at the drummer. The drummer is looking over at the guitarist. The guitarist is looking over at the clarinetist. Da, 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 da. Everybody's looking at each other. And when they kind of throw a ball out into the middle of the room, and somebody's like, oh, yeah. And then they pick it up. And then they throw another ball out, and then they're playing catch with this thing. And it's so much fun to watch this communication that is beyond words, that's beyond chords, that's beyond sounds. It's this communication of conceptualizing this mood or this spirit or this essence of a song. And for me, it's just so thrilling. I got close enough to music. I got second year in band and high school and middle school. But, you know, I never got far enough in where I could be the guy that could just do that stuff. But I can see it. And it's really amazing to be able to be in the room with people that are communicating and making something that is within your reach but beyond it at the same time, so that you can appreciate it, even if you kind of, you know, two left foot the dance, you can still see the eloquence of it and the playfulness of it. And I just love being in that spot. And it's been a blessing for me to be able to be in the spot with so many talented musicians and to then try and, you know, as best I can, provide a voice visually to that, a responsiveness visually to that. It's really a great challenge, and it's really a lot of play and fun for me. And at the same time, you get to sort of be a fire dancer with all these other people that are actually responsible for the fire. It's crazy. I would do music so much. It's really a joy.
It sounds like a joy. My gosh. Like I said, I could listen to you talk about it. You just have such passion. You could hear your passion through the way that you discuss working on something with music, or even just like working on scenes and lighting. So I also watched Abstract, which was a really incredible series on Netflix. I know that was with Morgan Neville as well. I watched the episode with Bjark Ingels, the architect, which was really cool and so interesting to see his work and learn about him.
There's some of that stuff was shot, I think, in Denmark, and yeah, some of it was shot in New York. Mm-hmm. And so there were, with Abstract, there were the my involvement on that was sort of parachute in and do a couple things here and there. So I have sprinkled my spice into the you know, the kneaded bread of that. When is it perfect? Like, I remember one thing in particular. He was insistent on this idea. To a beautiful directorial degree, he was insistent on this idea of this inception moment where Bjarke just seems to be floating.
I was going to ask you about that shot. Okay.
Yeah. And that was not done easily. That was done with some soul selling. I mean, uh-huh. that we had to fight off the demons to make that work. And Morgan, just when I say we, I mean he needed a trampoline.
Yeah.
And it like the production was like, how about like one of those little, like, you know, jazzercise trampolines that, you know, those little, that you always see throwing out on the streets of Brooklyn? No, it's not gonna work. And okay, how about this and how about that? And we can't really get it in time, it's not gonna happen. No, I need it to happen. He just had this relentless hammering, and when his hammer got taken away, he used his head to just hammer. You know, he just was so persistent. And production just kept thinking, like, do you really need it? Is it really? It's a very expensive shot. And he said, it's going to be how we start the show. I need it. And he just knows which nails need to be gilded, you know? They're all nails, but some of them, that one is solid gold. That was like a solid gold nail. And, you know, like, he just knows which ones to stand for and which other ones to be like, just shoot it. Just shoot it. I don't care. Just shoot it. And that shot, I think, you know, because it told so much of the story of this guy, this architect who lived in between worlds, this architect who created things that were not meant to be, but were being. And I think it was such a beautiful, you know, such a beautiful nail for him to make out of pure gold. And thank God we made it. By the hair of a chinny chin chin, we barely got that shot. There's a trampoline being delivered. It wasn't set up and delivered by, I think, like 4. And the sun was setting at 5:30, and we had to get the shot. It was really a nail biter, but it worked out great.
Well, I think my favorite part was that I watched it, and, you know, because I am a producer, when I watch things and I see things that are incredibly shot, I just wonder how they did it. And then I try to kind of figure out kind of the mechanics of it, because I have worked behind the scenes on many productions. And so I know, I've seen you at work, and I've seen a lot of other DPs at work, and I see some cool things that they do. But that shot, every time it came up, because they did weave pieces of it throughout the show, I was just like, how are they doing this? And what my favorite part was is that you guys lifted the curtain a little at the very end. And you showed that trampoline shot, and it was so satisfying for me, because I was like, how they did it. Oh, my God. And it was such a short clip that I was like, no, show more of that.
Yeah.
I was so excited to ask you about that shot. So I'm so glad that you actually were there for that. And it's incredible to think that it almost didn't happen.
You know, the another example in that same episode is that the playfulness of that with so much fun that you get to, when you get to know somebody and you get to spend time with them, you know, you can suggest to Morgan, like, oh, it'd be really funny. What if we did this? And he can sort of think about it for a second and say, no. And there's no, you know, there's no, like, sort of ego issue of, like, you're like, you know, but I'm a genius. You know, there's none of that nonsense. Or you can say something to him like, oh, it'd be really fun if we did this thing. And he'll be like, oh, that's a good idea. We should do that. There was this moment where Bjarke was, we were looking for an interview spot for him. And we found this one spot, and I said, oh, it'd be great if, you know, because he's leaning against a mirror, like, what, if it's a lock-off, like, why don't we just, you could do something where the mirror sort of has a sort of contrary reaction to him, or, like, you know, walks away, or, you know, laughs at him, or, you know, is on a different time frame than his. And it was like, oh, yeah, we should do that. And we did, and he actually made it into the movie, and it's like, you know, as a DP, to do something where you think, oh, that'd be really fun to do that, and to see it actually make it into the movie, yeah, it's just so fun, you know? Yeah. It's just really, awesome. It's candy. It's pretty great. That's one of my favorite moments in the whole thing because, you know, because I was throwing the spices in there. Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
I do, with the mirror with the two Bjarks. Yeah.
It's so subtle. Like, the one Bjarke just looks at him and is like, what are you talking about? Or something, you know? But it's just like, it just... You could miss it, or you could sort of appreciate it. And it's like, I love it that it's like, it has that level of like, you know, I don't need to bang this over your head. I'm just going to sort of, it's a little bit like a Haruki Murakami. I mean, not to sort of drop names, but like the Haruki Murakami novels, like they're all sort of unapologetically just either bombastic or just simple. Like they don't hit it over your head. Like, do you get it? It's a talking frog. In the above world, like, mm-hmm. There's this frog that's like human size. Let me tell it to you one more time. Do you get it? It's a frog that's talking. You know, he just says, like, the frog, and then the human frog was talking, and it just goes, it just moves on. And I just love that. Yeah. I love the sort of like unapologetic, like, yeah, we all got this.
That's very cool.
So I always find it interesting to ask people who are, I mean, you're obviously, inspiring people, I think, probably influencing other DPs who are watching your work. Who are some of the DPs and cinematographers who either from the past or presently working, whose work really inspires you and you just enjoy as a fan?
What I love most when I see things that I love the most, it's like I love that somebody has made something where I'm not caught up in the theatricity of the camera, but I'm caught up in the sort of the Murakami, like the hyper realism. Like it's just straightforward, but it's so slightly exaggerated, but not so much that it's like Avatar. You know, like mm-hmm. I get excited about, and this is where I'm going to drop the. Christopher Nolan, like all the Wong Kar-wai films, like mm-hmm. just so perfect, like so emotionally connecting to the viewer. You know, whether it's Happiness, where it's like it's really moody and really intense and lonely, or like In the Mood for Love, where it's just so lush, you know, and like those films like really impacted me because they created these landscapes that were had so much color and lighting and visual depth to them, but you felt like you were in a farmhouse, like you felt like you understood it, like you felt like you could have been in that space. You didn't feel like it was a members only space where you had to be clever enough to fit into it. And I think in the particular those films, just and like Roger Deakins, like I feel like he takes you to these places where, again, it's like he's such a, it's so cliche for a DP to say like Roger Deakins, you know, is really amazing, but I'm a cliche. I have Blundstones and I have, you know, but like, you know, you watch back the movies and you, like this, there's this scene where it's like the guy's buying stuff at a convenience store in like a small little like roadside gas station or something in No Country for Old Men. And it's this scene that's so intense. Mm-hmm. And nothing is really happening in it. And visually, it's not that leading. But, you know, it's sort of natural lighting and it's not super dark. And you don't feel like you're being noosed into this world. But somehow, you're a visual captive of this landscape. And there is this paintbrush that I feel like it's the beauty of it is when you are captivated by something and you can't really articulate why. That's just glory to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. His work in Sicario was just that tension that you were saying for No Country for Old Men. When I saw Sicario, I was just like, I want to like leap out of my seat watching this film because it's so tense. And it was a thing of beauty to watch.
So Graham, what is next or what are you able to talk about that's next on your plate?
I've been doing a lot of work with comedy lately, which is also glorious to me. I love being around the comedians and it's really nice to be around people that just want to make you laugh. And one sort of thing that I realized recently is that everybody thinks that comedians are these people that are just, you know, attention hungry, black holes. And what I've realized in this job that this one of this last job I just did for Amazon, where we followed these young and upcoming comedians on their way to greatness. But what it was shocking about all of them is that they all shared a generosity of laughter. They all really wanted to just laugh. They just wanted to laugh. They weren't trying to get you to laugh. I mean, of course they were trying to get you to laugh, but that they weren't trying myopically. They weren't trying at the cost of everything else to get you to laugh. They really just wanted to find the funny thing in the environment and point that out. And it's a bit like a magic trick, is one of the things that they sort of realized from the conversations with them. They're really just kind of taking something that shouldn't be funny and making it funny. Or they're taking something that didn't seem like it was funny and showing you how it was funny. Like pulling the laughter coin out of your ear at every turn. And it's not quite the same sort of joy as the sort of musician thing, but it's an equal joy, but in a different landscape. And so I've been doing a lot of work with comedians lately. I did the Wyatt Cenac show for HBO. Mm-hmm. And to be around people that are just trying to turn the negative into something positive, to do that magic trick, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And life skills, you know, it's great to just be able to be in the face of something that's slightly disastrous and be able to just find the comedy in it. So I seem to have switched from doing a lot of music stuff to doing a lot of comedy stuff, which is which is great. It's just the hand that life is dealing you, and I'm super happy with it. It's a great blessing. So now the things in the future are sort of more comedy oriented.
Oh, that's great.
In the landscape. Yeah.
I think it's interesting because I think quite often directors will get pigeonholed, and I know some directors fight against this. It's like, oh, you've done two great action pictures, keep doing action pictures. You've done two comedies, keep doing comedies. I mean, there are directors like Steven Soderbergh who never make the same movie twice, I guess, except for Oceans. He made that movie three times. But all that to say that it seems like you have a really nice freedom as a DP to be able to hop genres and just kind of follow your bliss, which must be pretty nice for you.
Well, you get what you get what you get, and you don't get upset, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
You know, if life hands you these things, you just I just happen to have gotten like an amazing blessing after blessing after blessing. It's like it's been pretty great. I mean, all of Morgan's stuff has just been great. But yeah, as a DP, you get pigeonholed. I mean, people sort of think, oh, he's a documentary DP. He's not going to be able to do, you know, Moonlight, you know, and it's like, it's true to a certain extent. Like you get these muscle memories where, you know, you start to develop a sensibility for, oh, well, this is how this scene needs to happen. And if you're used to sort of demanding like a jib and a you know lambda head and a you know crew of 10 and 10 and you know extra lights and you know 3 hours of lighting for each scene, it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense, you know. And as from a documentary perspective, you're like you're jumping up and down and singing your hallelujahs if you get a chance to set a light, you know. And so it's it's a different mindset, and you have to switch those gears. You really, I think that there's a, I remember Tammy Riker was a DP that I came up under, and she had this amazing knack for getting a documentary and then getting a feature and then getting a documentary and getting a feature. And she was super purposeful about it. And I think you have to be that intentional. I think you have to be deeply intentional. Otherwise, if you just sit there and wait to see what happens when the phone rings, it's just going to keep being the same ringtone. You know, it's just going to be the same thing.
Preach, Graham.
Yeah. So I think that intentionality is something that is gorgeous and, you know, requires a deep amount of will, but also requires a sort of a disillusionment for where you are. And I, so far, I've just been so, I feel so blessed to be able to be on all the different things that I've been on that I haven't felt a need to push away from it. But at a certain point that I do come from the world of multiple burners on the stove. So I'm sure at some point, that purposefulness to the jobs will rear its head and I'll have a hydra on my hands.
Maybe not the worst thing to happen.
No, hydras are good. They can fly and bite things. It's cool.
Exactly.
And they're hard to defeat.
You just spoke it into the universe. It's happening.
It's there.
Well, we are so, so grateful for you to take the time to speak with us. Thank you so much, Graham.
That's great to see you guys again. I can't believe I haven't seen you in so long. It'd be great to see you again.
It's so good to see you.
And here I am seeing you on the, you know, on the computer. 2018. You guys are a joyful treat. You, both of you, are. I don't know how you do it. For any of you who can't see these two people, they're just amazing. What sweet, wonderful people.
Oh, right back at you.
Thank you very much, Graham.
This has been lovely.
All right, Graham, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us on Inside Pop.
Well, thank you both for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
All right, we'll be back with the big sale after these short messages.
Welcome.
Thank you.
No problem.
These are real podcast listeners, not actors. What do you look for in a podcast?
Reliability is big for me.
Power.
I'd say comfort.
What do you think of this?
Oh.
That's Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
They came out of the floor?
And down from the ceiling?
That can't be safe.
I'm upset.
Can we go now?
Soon. Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
Beloved Maximum Fun Star Trek podcast, The Greatest Generation, is going out on tour.
We are bringing Greatest Gen Con to a bunch of cities in the U.S. and Canada. It's our big tribute to slash send-up of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And we have a big leg coming up.
Yes, we are raising our legs on a number of cities in the coming weeks.
We're going to Washington, D.C. on August 23rd, the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York on August 24th, Mass Mocha in North Adams, Massachusetts on August 25th, Pittsburgh on the 28th, Boston, Massachusetts at the Wilbur Theater on the 29th, Atlanta, Georgia at the Earl on the 30th, Ferndale, Michigan at the Magic Bag on the 31st.
Those are some great big rooms and some great big cities, Ben.
And it's a really fun show. It's accessible. Even if you haven't listened to the podcast yet.
We can't wait to see you when we're out on tour. Check greatestgencon.com for dates and ticketing information.
And Khan is spelled K-H-A-N because Wrath of Khan, greatestgen, K-H-A-N.com.
And welcome back to Inside Pop.
Now it is time for the Big Sell. It's rare that I get to describe the Big Sell. I usually leave it up to you, Sean. But the Big Sell is a segment where we enjoy something in pop culture so much that we need to sell it to the other host of the show. And once we sell it to them, they take the time to consume it, enjoy it, and come back the following episode and give us a lovely review and rating of that Big Sell.
Sometimes the reviews and ratings are more lovely than others. Let's see how lovely this week's review is. Last time, I big sold Amita a new podcast, at least new in my world. It's called Dissect, and essentially they spend every season dedicated to one artist and one album. This season, season three, they're dedicating their season to the artist Frank Ocean and two of his albums, Channel Orange and most recently Blonde. I big sold Amita the episode in which they dissect the song Pink and White, the third song on Blonde. So Amita, we don't talk about other podcasts a lot on the show, but I was taken with how I learned about Frank Ocean and also just got a good musical lesson and learned things like what a trill is, which I didn't honestly know exactly what a trill was, or kind of music counts, etc. So what did you think? What did you think of this podcast episode?
I enjoyed this podcast for the fact that I felt like I went back to music class and learning, like you said, about, you know, 4/4 count and 3/4 count and things that I did because I played a lot of instruments growing up. So it was really nice to kind of go back and get a little bit of that background and technical information about music and instruments. What I also loved is learning, it's not just about that. And that's the other piece of this that I enjoyed. As Song Exploder, you know, kind of the other podcast we have discussed on this on our show is Song Exploder kind of goes into like the creation of a song. This has this piece of like the musicality of it and the crafting of all the instruments that are involved. But then it also talks about the lyrics and some of the meanings and some of the origins of what he was possibly talking about. And that I really enjoyed about this podcast because I think sometimes I just listen to music and I'm so into a melody and I'm into a beat more than the lyrics. And I think we've discussed that. You're so into lyrics, I feel, because you'll always kind of quote them and sing them. And I am more about melody and the music and the beat. And so it was cool to hear some of the explanation of the song. And I think that was really what was unique about this podcast. I also enjoyed them, you know, mentioning how this song was produced by Pharrell, and Beyonce sang some background vocals for it. Oh, this is just like a super trifecta of genius.
And it really did make me, I mean, we all complained. I think everyone in the world complained about how it took Frank Ocean 4 years to come out with this album. But I think in listening to this episode and hearing about how it's, what is it, a 6-8 count, and that's kind of unusual mm-hmm. in music, and how the lyrics are just so poetic when they're broken down. And you're like, okay, yeah, the depth and complexity of that one song, multiply that by however many songs are on that album. Okay, yeah, I see why it took you 4 years. There's a lot of artistry and thought and work that went into that. So, yeah, it helped me to appreciate the time that he took to come out with Blonde. So that's another reason why I liked that episode as well. Just to school me and to remind me of what real songwriters and real musicians, the effort that they put into music. So I'm glad that you appreciated that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, I really did. I really did. It made me want to listen to the previous seasons, because I believe you told me one was about Kendrick Lamar's album and the other one was about Kanye West.
Yeah, I think How to Pimp a Butterfly and My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, respectively. So say what you want about Kanye, but that album is the peak. It's the best. So yeah, I would like to listen. I might, like, you know, kind of hand pick. I'm definitely let me listen to All of the Lights. Let me listen to Monster Dissect. I want that in-depth knowledge about Monster. You know, and ditto the Channel Orange section of season 3. I may not listen to every single song, but I'd love to hear the dissection of Thinking About You and Solo. I can't wait to hear that episode.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think Dissect is going to be a podcast where I'll hunt and peck, because...
Yes.
Who has time, ladies and gentlemen, to listen to every single episode of every single podcast you like, except for Inside Pop? Listen to all of our episodes? Nobody.
Yes, please.
So what rating do you have?
Please listen to all of our episodes.
Yeah, do it. Now, so what rating are you going to give to Dissect Season 3, Pink and White?
I'm going to give this a good 3.25 stars. Oh, yeah, I think I'm on a run of a lot of 3.25 stars right now. But this is really, really entertaining. And like I said, I think the proof is in the fact that I want to continue to listen to more of these episodes and learn more about the music that I enjoy.
Love it. Why don't you do that? And then, you know, we don't have to be all formal in the big cell, but feel free to chime in during a future episode of Meet about how you're enjoying future episodes.
I will. I mean, listen, the fact that he did My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy and I can possibly hear them talk about the French horns in All of the Lights. Truth be told, I played the French horn for many years in high school. So I'm going to look forward to hopefully him discussing that.
Someday we're going to put a picture of Amita playing that French horn in the show notes.
I don't think they exist.
I have my druthers.
Too bad. Wah, wah.
Do I have your brother's phone number or email address? I think I do. All right. So.
No, you don't.
All right. Well, what do you have to big sell to moi aujourd'hui?
Well, this week, I would love to big sell you an artist that I am looking really forward to seeing at Afropunk. And I remembered you had sold me Jacob Banks a couple weeks ago, and you were so excited to see him at Afropunk. So this is my reciprocal offering to of this artist that I can't wait to see at Afropunk, and I hope you haven't heard of them. Their name is Ibeyi.
I love Ibeyi so much.
Oh, you have heard of them.
But maybe you're going to sell me something of theirs incredible. I haven't heard. But I listened to their most recent album a lot.
Ash, it's so good.
He said. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so big sell to everybody. Please just find Ibeyi. It's Ibeyi. They are twin sisters. They have Afro-Cuban roots. Their dad was a drummer for the Buena Vista Social Club. They are incredible singers, and they have incredible harmonies and have this cool, earthy, R&B, soulful, jazz vibe to them that I love. There was a song from a previous album called River. Do you know that song?
I do not know that song.
Okay. River is how I got into them. I heard them sing this, I believe, on an episode of Queen Sugar. It was featured in an episode of Queen Sugar, I think in season 2. And I really enjoyed the sound. So River is such an incredible song from their album, their self-titled album. And it was from 2015, I believe. And the video is cool and crazy. It's one shot. They are essentially underwater for each of the parts that they're not singing in one long shot. And so listen to the track, watch the video. It's really, really cool. And I can't wait for them to perform this at Afropunk.
Amita Patel, there are a few incredible songs with the word river in them, in their title, that I absolutely love. For example, Joni Mitchell's River. Oh, I wish I had a river to skate away on. The mm-hmm. best. Rolling on the River, covered by Tina Turner, the best. Many Rivers to Cross, covered by the Annie Lennox. I love songs with the song River. REM's Find the River, which closes out their seminal album. I'm crazy.
Oh my gosh, so many.
Automatic for the People. So, Will, I'm being dramatic now. Will This River by Ibeyi reach the pinnacle of love that Sean has for these other river songs? Tune in the next episode and find out.
Yeah, and we'll tease a little something. I will discuss their connections to Beyonce in the next episode when he gives his review.
Intrigued.
Yes.
Okay, can I do a little plug? I've been doing this privately, but maybe I'll share it with you and our amazing, sexy listeners. I've been creating a playlist on Spotify called Afropunk 2018 Warm Up.
Ooh.
Basically just featuring music from all of the bands and music that I love and that I'm discovering as I warm up for Afropunk. What if I shared that with you and the listeners?
Yes,
I might do it
please.
Early, ahead of the release of this episode. So
please,
this is a little bit
soon.
Of time travel happening right now. But yeah, it's going to happen. Okay, that's just a gift that I want to give to you. I can't help my generosity.
I can't wait. And can I add to this list of all the Afropunk artists that I enjoy?
Oh, you're testing me. In the spirit of Afropunk, okay?
Oh my God, you are so... so possessive about your playlist, Sean.
I thought I would like collaborative playlist, but nope. I'm kind of...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's fine. I get it. Fine.
May I ask one thing of you, Amita?
Nope.
Can you give me a day to try to find my better self that just very freely says yes to you? Give me 24 hours.
Fine.
He's in there, Amita. You know that.
I was like, I'm not going to go crazy with this. I'm pretty busy in life. I just would maybe look at your list and see some of the artists that may not have been included that I enjoy and put a couple of songs of those artists.
Okay. Let's do it. Amita, what's up with the shade? Okay, let's try this again. Amita, you'd like to contribute and collaborate on my Afropunk 2018 warm-up list?
Yes.
Of course. There are very few things that would bring me greater happiness. Let's do it. I'll send you the link.
I can't wait, Sean. Thank you.
That was easy.
You're so generous and kind. And sharing is caring.
Okay. Yeah. So the sincerity that's happening right now is overwhelming. So I think we should actually end our episode. Thank you, sexy listeners, for listening to an episode. We had a lot of fun creating this episode for you, and we hope you had as much fun listening to it. So make sure to stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that in a number of different ways. You can go to Twitter and Instagram and use the @PopInsiders handle to find us. You can also like us on Facebook and visit our official site at insidepoppodcast.com.
you to go to that site. You should subscribe, listen to old episodes, find out more about us. And you can also go to MaximumFun.org to listen to this episode and find old episodes as well. And also find other podcasts dedicated to pop culture and comedy.
Coming up in future episodes of Inside Pop, we will continue to have interviews, have conversations with people who are creating the culture you crave. And of course, we'll be following the big fall TV season. It is upon us. It is nigh. We'll be, of course, giving you a breakdown of the Emmy Awards and all the other autumn offerings that pop culture has. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Inside Pop.
Bye, y'all.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.